Why do people in Canada survive longer with cystic fibrosis than those in the U.S.?
Should we extend treatment with blood thinners in people that have had vein clots?
Where's the best place to have rehabilitation if you've had your knee replaced?
And are we as effective at reducing strokes in people with atrial fibrillation as we should be?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 17th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Likewise. Are you wearing green?
No. I always forget, and it seems like a real problem, especially since many of my forebears are, in fact, Irish. Enough of that, then. And I'm also not planning to go out and drink a bunch of green beer. I suspect you aren't either.
That's true.
Okay. Let's turn to this study in Annals of Internal Medicine. Rather disturbing in some ways, but also an opportunity, I guess. Folks with cystic fibrosis there survive significantly longer than people who have the same condition here in the U.S.
It's a good news, bad news story. The good news is this is a great use of registry information to inform us of how well we're doing with regard to treatment of cystic fibrosis. As you know, this is a genetically inherited disease that affects nutrition, lung function, and it results in reduced survival. This registry data is data not only collected in the United States, but in Canada as well. If you look at registry patients in the United States and Canada, over the last 20 to 25 years, survival has been increasing in both countries. But in 2000, it appears that the Canadian survival increased faster than survival in patients in the United States. So that now there's about a 10-year gap.
And I think that we have some idea of why that's true.
It is known that individuals in Canada are more likely to receive a lung transplant and earlier than individuals in the United States. Now, that can only account for some of the difference, not all of it. Probably access to care is also important. If you compare our Medicaid, Medicare patients or our uninsured patients to those in Canada where there is universal access to health, the Canadian patients do better. When you compare our insured patients to the Canadian system, there was no difference in survival. So that suggests that access to health care may also play an important role in addition to earlier use of lung transplantation.
It's great, of course, that we can get our arms around factors that could help prolong survival in these folks. I'm not sure there's a lot we can do, though, about the transplantation issue in view of the fact that organs, of course, are in short supply.
Well, organs are in no more shorter supply in the United States than they are in Canada. The question is, are we waiting too late to transplant patients? Perhaps the care after transplantation could be different. We need to also address access to care, and that would include access to transplantation as well. The good news is this registry data gives us something we can sink our teeth into. We can point to it and say there is clearly a difference, and what can we do to address this in the United States?
I'm wondering if there's anything in this study about the availability of organs for transplantation, because I'm wondering if the Canadians are more willing to sign up for organ donation. We certainly have an issue with that here domestically.
This doesn't specifically address that, so it's hard to say, but it does give us enough of a foundation to drill a little bit deeper, and I think your suggestion's great.
That is the one I'm going to talk about on the blog this week. Let's turn from here then to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Something I thought was really fascinating. Gosh, if you've had your knee replaced, if you have inpatient rehabilitation versus outpatient rehabilitation, what are the outcomes?
This is important because the number of knee replacements has increased substantially over the last 20 years. It's increased about 11-fold, as a matter of fact. The therapy of patients afterwards varies dramatically across the globe. In the United States and in Sweden, there's a significant number of individuals that are referred to inpatient rehabilitation after they have their knee surgery. In fact, about 40% of patients. Whereas in other places, it's used relatively infrequently. Is there any benefit to inpatient therapy versus outpatient therapy? These investigators took 165 patients and they randomized them to receive inpatient therapy for 10 days after their knee replacement, some to receive home-based therapy. Then they had a third group, that was an observational group. Those individuals said, I don't really want to enroll in the study. I prefer to have outpatient home-based therapy. And they followed them for up to a year. They assessed how quickly they recovered over a course of 6 minutes, how far could they walk, and how did they feel? What was the quality of their life and what was was their pain intensity. And what they realized was that the inpatient therapy offered no benefit. Patients didn't feel better, their quality of life was no better, and they didn't return to walking any faster or any longer. This suggests that good home-based therapy, which is obviously much less expensive to administer, is just as good as intensive inpatient rehabilitation after knee replacement.
And what exactly was the cost differential?
Well, they didn't examine it. There were plans to do a cost-effectiveness study, but when they found out that it wasn't any better, they didn't do it.
Seems to me that there are going to be some folks who are going to be resistant, however, to implementing a home-based rehabilitation program fully.
That may be the case. One has to ask, though, is that the responsibility of the patient to pay for that or the insurance company to pay for that? Because that's an issue of preference. It's not an issue of evidence-based medicine. Where do you want to go next?
Let us stay in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We are underutilizing anticoagulation in people with atrial fibrillation, and oops, they're having more strokes.
Previous studies have looked at people with atrial fibrillation and identified that it increases their risk of stroke 4 to 5-fold over patients that don't have this irregular rhythm abnormality. So studies have looked at the use of aspirin or anticoagulation, warfarin or Coumadin, or one of these novel oral anticoagulants to see if it can lower the risk of stroke. And what they've discovered is aspirin reduces it by about 35%, and these other anticoagulants reduces it by between 60 and 70%. Well, this study looked at just the opposite. It took people with atrial fibrillation that were considered to be at high risk and should have been on anticoagulation, and these individuals had a stroke. How many of those people were on anticoagulation, and if so, were they adequately anticoagulated? And what they found was only about 15% were on anticoagulation and at the right dose. 85% of individuals either weren't on it, about 30%, were on it but were on an inadequate dose, that was about 40%, and about 15% were only taking aspirin. We have a lot of room for improvement. Take it a step further, those individuals who had a stroke but were on appropriate anticoagulation had a less severe stroke and were more likely to recover.
Very powerful and compelling evidence then that the right dose, the right agent for anticoagulation for people with atrial fibrillation is really important.
It is.
Doesn't seem to be much more to say about that except for, gosh, we've got some work to do getting that message out there.
It is. This is a preventable cause of stroke, and our listeners need to be aware of it.
Okay. Something that's related to this, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. Deep vein thrombosis, something that can be very troubling and also life-threatening for some patients. Gosh, how can we manage that?
When deep vein thrombosis is recognized, it's typically treated with an anticoagulant, a blood thinner, for at least 3 months, sometimes 3 to 6 months. And once someone has had it, we try to identify, is there a reason for it? Was it provoked? For example, did they have recent surgery and have been at bed rest? Or was it unprovoked? We can't find a cause. If a cause has been identified, typically those people are put on anticoagulation for 3 months. The question is, should we extend it for a little bit longer? And if so, with aspirin or more of a blood thinner? Because you have to weigh the risk of additional benefit versus the risk of bleeding. So these investigators took almost 3,500 patients that had had a DVT. They completed their usual 3 to 6 months. And then they asked the question, well, let's put them on a little bit longer anticoagulation for 6 to 12 months with either aspirin or a blood thinner, regular dose or low dose, and let's see the outcome. What they discovered was that patients treated with aspirin, there was still a risk of DVT recurrence, 4 to 6% risk, sometimes fatal, sometimes not fatal, and they could reduce that 70% by putting people on an oral anticoagulant. Now, it didn't matter whether it was regular dose or low dose, but it reduced the risk by about 70%. And by the way, that was for patients that had an identifiable cause, that is provoked, even for those that had unprovoked DVT. So this suggests to me that we ought to be extending anticoagulation for a little bit longer, perhaps 6 to 12 months. Now, you ask the question, well, what's the risk of bleeding? Well, the risk of bleeding was very low. It was about 0.3 to 0.5% regardless of the therapy. So additional benefit for prolonging anticoagulation in these individuals at a very low risk of having severe bleeding.
How about the agent?
This is one of the newer novel oral anticoagulants. It doesn't require routine monitoring. You don't have to adjust the dose. And it has been associated with a lower risk of bleeding compared to the more conventional therapy, that is warfarin or Coumadin. So I'm glad you brought that up. When we talk about using prolonged therapy, it's with one of these newer agents. Specifically, this is rivaroxaban.
Would you suggest that the other ones that are a part of this class might also be effective?
There is a study that suggests a similar one called apixaban can also be effective if used for a prolonged period of time. The difference is one takes that twice a day as opposed to the rivaroxaban, which is administered as a single daily dose.
Excellent. So this is good news. On that note, I've already said what I'm going to talk about this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.